Make Me Smart is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace. Do you ever wonder what's happening behind the scenes of the multi-trillion dollar fashion industry? In the new podcast, Fashion People, Puck correspondent and 20-year fashion veteran Lauren Sherman and a rotating cast of industry insiders discuss what fashion people are really talking about behind the scenes of the star-studded business, from creative director switcheroos to M&A drama, DTC downfalls, and Met Gala mishaps. Fashion People, a presentation of Odyssey in partnership with Puck, is available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, we're rocking it.
We are. And we're not even caught too terribly much by surprise. Hey, everybody, it's Kai Rizdahl. It is, of course, Make Me Smart. If that's not what you were expecting, well, stick around anyway, because it's always good. That's all I'm saying.
You're going to love it. I'm Molly Wood. It is Tuesday. That means the day where none of us is as smart as all of us, a weekly deep dive into a single topic with some help. Today, that topic, as we mentioned last week, we had had this rolling series of conversations where everyone we were talking to was like, this is what's going on with my parents and the vaccine and me and the vaccine, and I'm trying this and that. So we thought, hey, that seems like a good topic for a show.
Yeah, because honestly, I am adrift in this thing. Joe Biden takes office tomorrow. He has promised that he is going to fix the vaccine rollout, which I'm just going to go out on a limb here and say is going to be a challenge just because of the way things have been left for him by the prior administration. Something like 3 million vaccine doses have been distributed. Only 12 million, though, Americans have received that first dose, which is not a whole lot of people. Right. Sorry, 31 million. Sorry, my bad.
Right. Okay, yeah.
31 million.
And then, of course, it is a race against time. I don't think we can say that strongly enough, because the vaccine is rolling out slowly and the more contagious variant is rolling out quickly. And health officials are warning that it could become the dominant source, the dominant virus in circulation by March. Heaven help us. I know you don't want to hear the word March ever again. We may have to rename that month. But that news is coming as 4,000 people are dying every day in the United States. So it couldn't be more urgent.
Which is why we got Dan Polsky on the phone. He's a health economist at Johns Hopkins. He's also serving on the National Academy's Committee for Vaccine Distribution. Dan, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
So with the caveat that this is only like a half hour podcast, how come this vaccine rollout has been such a mess?
In 30 minutes, huh? I'm an optimistic guy, so I want to start with a glass half full kind of view here, which is that we have a vaccine.
Yeah.
The like you said, March, that's not even a year ago. You know, the idea to get everybody vaccinated and get back to normal is something everyone wants yesterday. I think there's a natural tension just by, you know, that very nature. But that being said, you know, to deliver vaccines to, you know, the 300 million people in the United States requires a lot of advanced planning and funding and excellent communication and a set of, federal guardrails to keep everyone in line. And so those are four elements that I think haven't really gone as, we wish they would have and has led us to where we sit today. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think let's tease that apart, because of course there's the natural tension and the desire to rush what is already a miracle, the existence of a vaccine this quickly. But let's try to tease apart, though, that from the part that's an actual failure. Like, you know, if you had to sort of have a continuum, is it 50% failure and 50% this is how a miracle goes? It's messier than you think.
Well, you know, the original goal was 20 million doses by the end of the year. And like you said, in the intro, we are at about 13 or 14 million doses delivered. And so, you know, from that measure, I think it's a failure. I would say a kind of moderate failure. And I think the larger failure is with respect to trust and communication and expectations. And so, you know, as someone who did a lot of advanced planning back in the summer as part of this National Academies committee that you mentioned, you know, we were working in the summer to think about early on, there's going to be a limited number of doses available. So who should get them first so that we can be equitable in the distribution of vaccines? And so as things start to ramp up, there can be more trust in the system. And that planning was happening way back in the summer. So the idea that we would be sitting here today and the sense is that we have no plan is an abject failure. And that's where I think, you know, I would give a score of like 1 or 2 of 10. No one seems to think that we have a plan.
Yeah. Mm. So let's assume, well, no, because we're dealing with fact here, right? Joe Biden walks in tomorrow, and this is arguably item number one on his plate. How long do you think it will take him, and I know I'm putting a lot of weight on his shoulders, but hey, you wanted the job, you got the job, to get things to a point where people aren't yelling and screaming about what a failure it is anymore?
Well, he just last week set his goal, which is 100 million vaccines in 100 days. So
do you think that's doable? Is it realistic?
I think it's realistic. I mean, if I think this past week we were averaging about almost a million doses a day, maybe 800,000. So it's in the realm of possibilities. But I think that as there's a deeper understanding of things that went wrong, and as some of the veil is getting lifted about the planning or lack of planning during the Trump administration, I would say that the people who came up with this goal are nervous.
Because there's information they don't have about what is not working, or frankly, how many doses we have. I'm going to get to the stockpile question.
I think so. There are going to be enough doses to get 100 million. Yeah. Out there, at least that's the news that I've most recently seen. It's more about on the ground. Can we ramp up sufficiently to have trained staff that are on the ground in not only all 50 states, all 3,000 some counties and localities to have, you know, mass vaccination campaigns. I think the early dosing has kind of picked up speed, largely because it's been fairly centralized in hospitals and now hopefully, you know, increasingly in nursing homes. But when you really got to get out there to everybody, it just requires a completely different logistical challenge.
Right. Can you help us understand the one dose versus two dose policy question and then this decision to release a stockpile that had apparently already been depleted?
Yeah. It's,
no pressure. Yeah. You're like, I'd rather not.
So the trials, you know, where we have the deepest science with the randomized trials for these two vaccines that are out in the market, was based on a two-dose regimen. So if we're going to sit firmly within what we has proven and what we know works, there's a view that we should be sticking with this two-dose regimen. To the extent we have information on the effectiveness of one dose, it works on an individual well, but not as well as the two-dose, you know, sticking with the, you know, not the required regimen, but at least the one that was used in the clinical trial. So you could get if you're a doctor working one-on-one, you'd say, well, you know, I think you should do two doses. But if you're sitting, you know, for a nation or a state and think about community health, it's not an obvious answer, because when you get vaccinated, it doesn't just affect you, but it affects the people around you, because then you're less likely to spread the disease. So if you just think about it from a kind of national welfare perspective, it might be better to give one dose and get more people vaccinated. At least better for society, which is a little different than an individual decision. If I was a doctor, I'd say, and you know, if I was talking to my mother, for example, mm-hmm. I'd say you should get your two doses because you know you really want that 95% protection. So that's the trade-off from a scientific perspective. And I don't think anyone has, you know, successfully completed a model or has the right data to say which is the better decision. So it's not really a political choice. It really is, I think, an interesting question about the best strategy to move forward. I don't think people have a good sense about what would yield the best outcomes.
Sorry, just as a follow-up, but we decided to do that, right? As a matter of policy, like, is it going to be up to people to say, I prefer two doses?
I think it's, I think people can still get two doses. It's just, it's about making sure that we ramp up. It's better to get people, you know, one dose. You're supposed to get the second dose 3 to 4 weeks or something. I don't have it exactly, the exact timing in front of me, but you know, you might get the second dose in a more delayed fashion because the place you got the first dose isn't getting the supply fast enough or reserving a supply to make sure they can deliver that second dose when you come back 3 weeks later. So it's a question of delay, that there's a chance for delay because I'd rather rush my doses that I have in my freezer out to as many people as possible. And I'll just cross my fingers that that next truck shows up 3 weeks later.
Which is kind of crazy. Yeah, it's just kind of wild that that's what we're thinking about. Well, so look, among the planning failures in the prior administration and the lack of budgeting and all of that that we've talked about, we are a little bit trapped by the success of the scientists, right? I mean, the scientists got this out in world record time before the logisticians really were able to say, okay, here's slot A into tab B, right?
Record time. I think it's at least 2 years to develop a vaccine. So it's quite extraordinary.
Yeah. And we couldn't figure out the logistics protocols fast enough. That's the sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think maybe the focus on the science over the logistics, it's just, you know, it's a more centralized effort, right? You know, give one group some funding and they're well set up already to innovate versus work within a public health infrastructure that has already been depleted over many decades and try to do a rollout where you have to start an entire infrastructure from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, do you think that's going to be some of the takeaway from this experience already, even though it's obviously still happening and very acute, is, you know, the decades spent underfunding public health are showing, let's say.
Are showing, yeah. And I'll just say, you know, when I was working with this committee over the summer and we were tasked with putting a framework together for the equitable allocation of vaccines, most of the report focuses on how to allocate, how to get vaccinations out into everybody's arms. So one of our recommendations was, you know, there's phase one, phase two, phase three, and this is, you know, a suggestion for how things, you know, for how to dole out a vaccine when there's limited supply. But we spent a lot of time discussing the need to have no out-of-pocket spending. If you're going to get your vaccine, you can get it for free. That it should be risk communication needs to be funded at high levels and really work on community engagement, that there should be an entire vaccination promotion campaign and focus on vaccine acceptance. And a lot of that's the bulk of our report. And it seems that the focus has really been on, you know, who gets it first. And that's just, you know, one piece. And I think that what has happened is that states and organizations stuck to these rules quite rigidly. And I think that is something else that's turned out to be a bit of a shame, because sometimes you stick to you're required to give a dose to these three people, and then you have doses left over at the end of the day, and you can't find people that meet that criteria, and you end up having to throw away doses. And I think that that's something else that just seems to boggle the mind.
It does indeed. All right. So as a way to sort of put a punctuation mark on this, Dan, on the theory that more vaccine is coming, because more vaccine is coming, right? Question mark. How long do you suppose it takes us to get to a place where we have the desired and medically necessary degree of coverage?
I don't think I can, you know, that's not my expertise, but I'm an optimist. So, you know, I have children in school, so I'm hoping, you know, by the fall, you know, we can all send our kids to school safely and hitting, you know, whatever this rate is where we can return to normal, probably will be a little bit, you know, further along than that.
Yeah, I'm crossing my fingers for my kids going to school in the fall. That's all I'm saying.
I mean, dude, that's like my shining North Star at this point. Dan Polsky is a health economist at Johns Hopkins University and served on the National Academy's Committee for Vaccine Distribution. Thanks so much for the time, Dan.
Oh, thanks for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan. It's there's so many. I mean, look, this is a monstrously complicated logistical problem, but one would have hoped.
I mean, look, we have to be real. We have to be realistic and honest, I think, about priorities. And I guess in some ways this was not one of them, weirdly, even though it was the only solution in the canon, you know?
Right.
But demonstrably was not a priority in that. And that like, it shows.
Yep.
Is all. Yeah.
Yeah.
We are headed to a break. But I actually do, though.
Yeah.
I've now, you know, spoken to a couple of people who have appointments to get the vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like my son's grandparents are going to get their shots in 10 days. And that really is incredible. Like, it's easy to lose sight in all the bad part of it and the delay or whatever, that people are actually getting vaccinated. That is incredible.
Yeah.
It's incredible. So.
Yeah. Look, I got my mom an appointment. So,
good work.
Yeah. Well, it took half an hour of me on the phone with my mom, me doing the computer stuff while she talked me through like account numbers and stuff. But anyway, so we're getting there.
Whatever. Great. You know, we're getting there.
Yep.
All right. We're headed to a break. Send us your comments on today's show. I still have a lot of questions about the one dose, two dose thing. I'm going to keep digging into that. I'm sure you do too. Send us an email or a voice memo, makemesmart@marketplace.org. We'll be right back with some news.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Get one of the most successful broadcasts in television history on your schedule with the 60 Minutes podcast. Hard-hitting investigative reports, news, and culture maker interviews, and in-depth profiles are waiting for you in every episode. Listen to 60 Minutes every Sunday wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hello. We're back. Just like that. Just like magic. We never went anywhere. All right. It's time for the news fix. Kai is turning over a new leaf in 2021. He has two links.
I have two links, but they're basically the same story. So yesterday, on the national holiday set aside for Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and a day of service and remembering all that Dr. King stood for, both in history past and history to come, I think it was just so on the nose that yesterday is the day that the White House decided to release its 1776 report, which, of course, was the White House's attempt to get, and this is the quote, patriotic education back in American life. And the upshot is that basically we are not a liberal democracy because of all the things we've gone through. We're just who we are because we're good and we were right from the outset, forgetting slavery and oppression and lack of progressivism and all of that stuff. And that just, read this report. It's just gobsmacking. But my number two item is a tweet this morning from the Secretary of State of the United States of America for another 24-something hours. Mike Pompeo tweets this from his official government account this morning. Wokeism, multiculturalism, all the isms, they are not who America is. They distort our glorious founding and what this country is all about. I don't understand how you can represent the United States to the world and think that, much less say it out loud.
On your official government account.
I know. Here's one more quote from this tweet.
Multiculturalism is not who America is really pretty remarkable.
Censorship, wokeness, political correctness, it all points in one direction, authoritarianism cloaked as moral righteousness. I don't understand. Anyway, so those are my items to close out the Trump administration, because this is the last podcast that we're going to do before he leaves office.
Yeah. I got to say, to put a slightly more positive spin on it, good job to the 1619 Project.
Yeah.
Which was so impactful and so revealing that it literally provoked a counter report from the Trump administration, which is now finding itself in the position of arguing that the American progressive movement is basically fascist. Yeah. It likens the American progressive movement of the early 20th century to the fascism of leaders like Benito Mussolini, who it said, quote, sought to centralize power under the management of so-called experts.
Yep. Kind of amazing.
Congratulations, 1619 Project. Yep. You officially have a counter movement.
Yeah.
And it's actually pretty amazing, because the thing that I brought today, because I also was sort of like headed back down the rabbit hole, I would like to say that I have not been on Twitter for like 35 hours and I feel amazing.
How's that going?
You know how they say you should exercise more and drink more water and like eat vegetarian?
Did you see that thing about how misinformation on the internet has declined 73% since President Trump has been off Twitter?
Wow.
Yeah.
Thinking that it's noticeable. It's palpable.
Yeah.
The absence. And it really makes you wonder what would have happened if they had enforce the rules earlier.
Yep.
I was like, I think that the other counter programming to all of the kind of fear and worry and whatever is like that I just wanted to acknowledge is the three firsts that are going to occur tomorrow in the form of one human being, that human being Kamala Harris,
yep,
who will become the first woman, the first black woman, and the first Asian American to be the vice president of the United States. And it's just remarkable. And yeah, it's been buried under all of this stuff. But like the living human counterpoint to the Mike Pompeo tweet
right,
is the actual personhood of Kamala Harris. And that is remarkable and should not be taken away from her or this country, which is in fact empirically multicultural. That's just an absurd statement.
All right.
Enough
of us. Over to you.
Hello, Molly and Kai.
It's Brianna from Phoenix.
Ivan from Brooklyn, New York.
Longtime listener, first time voicemailer.
I want to discuss a slightly different, but maybe related thing.
All right, so we did disinformation last week. Here comes Lloyd in California starting us off.
We do not find ourselves in our current civic situation because of disinformation. Fundamentally, a tragically large proportion of our population is racist, sexist, xenophobic, anti-Semitic, and white supremacist. We were the last democracy to do away with slavery, and we had to fight a war to end it. Religious and civic bigotry is fundamentally American. Trump sensed that and took advantage of it. And Facebook is not the problem, no matter how much we don't like Zuckerberg. Facebook can't make people believe unless they want to believe. The disinformation was not the fundamental problem. The problem was that people believe the lies and will continue to do so because they already believed the lies before they were told.
Yeah, I think the issue here, Lloyd, is that Facebook and Twitter and Parler and all the rest of them, not to equate all those three, but you know what I mean, and facilitated the spreading of the big lie, right? And then that let people tap into what they were feeling. That's what I think.
Yeah, I think all the things are true, to Lloyd's point. Like, all of those things were pre-existing. I mean, look, the first part of Mike Pompeo's tweet might hurt your brain. The second part is true. Our enemies stoke these divisions mm-hmm. because they know they make us weaker. Define enemies how you will. The fact is that, you know, divisions were taken advantage of at a time of anger, insecurity, scarcity, pre-existing racism, sexism, xenophobia, anti-Semitism, and white supremacy. Like, yes, all of that is true. And then on top of that, we have no immunity to social media. And if you sort of, if you assume that hate itself is a disease that has to be managed, when you give somebody the candy and you keep algorithmically promoting the candy and then letting other people make money off of making more candy, like, pretty soon you have a big problem.
Want some with algorithmic hate candy?
Yeah. Hate obesity. Right, I don't know right. where this metaphor None. Is going to end, but
lean in. Yeah.
But yes, and it is important to acknowledge that. It's also important not to oversimplify that either. Right. Like, it's anyway.
Yep.
On our show, we try not to oversimplify, but it's really hard.
Yeah.
Not anyway. Yeah. It's a yes. Yes, Lloyd. All of that. Yeah. And then some. John in Kansas sent in this memo after our discussion about corporations suspending political donations.
Forgive the cynical take, but I'm not really seeing these as rebukes of elected officials for participation in the big lie or incitement of violence. More like PR risk management. Sure, Hallmark is asking for their money back from Josh Hawley, but most aren't standing up for specific actions. They're suspending all contributions, and some only for a limited period of time. Boeing is case in point here, saying, given the current environment, we're not making political contributions at this time, which seems rather toothless and vague and more like a strategy to not offend anybody and not put themselves in the limelight, and less like actually standing up for democracy or any principles. Curious to hear your thoughts.
I basically agree with that. There are companies out there that are suspending, as we talked about, I think, last week, suspending donations to both Democrats and Republicans. And it's like, why mm-hmm. are you doing that? Also, this is a politically fallow time anyway for fundraising, right? I mean, the campaign is done. The inaugural committee's gotten its money. Nobody's running for anything for another 18 months. It's a very convenient time to be able to say, oh, we're going to take a pause in our political contributions, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I will say that reputational risk is, however, the biggest motivating factor for business, or one of the biggest, right? Yep. It's a big motivator. Yep. And so if it is good PR not to give money to politicians who tried to overturn the election, and that's why companies do it, it still has the effect of withdrawing money from politicians who voted to try to overturn the election. So, like, the why may matter less than the how many. And the Washington Post had a story today, actually, about how they contacted the 30 companies that gave the most money to election objecting lawmakers' campaigns. 20 of those firms, which is not all, but it is 20 out of 30, have pledged to suspend some or all payments from their political action committees.
Yeah, I just think that in 6 months, when the Acme widget company has some issue in front of Senator X that it wants taken care of, Absolutely. It's going to give Senator X, you know, $11 gajillion, no matter how Senator X voted on the election.
I mean, this is why, to Lloyd's point, actually, like, we all need to, we are fighting each other instead of, like, wealth inequality and companies that continue to make money through all of this.
Right.
No, like, very few companies at a massive scale, like, saw their stock price go down during a pandemic and an insurrection and the kind of upheaval that we've seen over the last 9 months. And so, like, the more we fight with each other, the more we are actually not paying attention to the real issue, which is the precarious state of American capitalism, which we've been discussing for 4 years on the show. Yeah. All right, finally, we're going to leave you with the answer to the Make Me Smart question, which, of course, is, what is something you thought you knew that you later found out you were wrong about?
Gabriel in Puerto Rico sent us this.
Something I thought I knew but turns out I was wrong. Instead, I thought that the 1954 shooting of the U.S. House of Representatives was something mainstream, common knowledge, but in the conversation about the January 6th events, nobody's talking about that. Everybody's saying that there has never been an attack in the Capitol in 200 years, and that's completely wrong. March 1 of 1964, Lolita Lebron and a couple of other Puerto Ricans did shoot the House of Representatives. And so that's something that a lot of people seem to not know.
Yeah. History is cool and scary and interesting and all that stuff. That's, yes, to everything Gabriel said.
I did not know this either.
Yeah, very big deal.
I just looked it up.
Yep.
That's fascinating. It was all part of the independence movement.
Yeah.
Five representatives were wounded, one seriously, all recovered. And the assailants were given life sentences for all intents and purposes. And then their sentences were commuted
by Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter in 79. Lolita LeBron lives till like 2010 or something. Yeah, it's a big deal. Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, it's kind of wild.
Look at that.
It's kind of wild.
Sometimes we all learn together in real time.
And that's why we have this podcast, people, so we can all learn together in
real
time.
Thank you, Gabriel. That's so interesting.
Oh, man. All right. So I think that is all for today. Tomorrow is What Do You Want to Know? Wednesday. Your questions, please.
Already?
Short week. Questions come to us at makemesmart@marketplace.org. Voice memos are better. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah. They just improve your odds. It's like entering more times.
Buying an extra lottery ticket. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Marissa Cabrera. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. Ben Heathcote does video for us. Erica Phillips writes our newsletters and our smart speaker skills.
Today's program was engineered by Garrett Lang and mixed by Ben Tolliday. And the same Ben composed our theme music along with Daniel Ramirez. The senior producer is Donna Tam. The executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves.
There we go. Boom.
Pew.
We're out,
look
too,
at
we're
that.
Out too
right
soon.
On time.
We're out too soon. I saw some tweet the other day. This guy said this was the best podcast theme song he ever heard. That's true.
Look at that. I mean, I think it's true. Yeah, I got no beef with that statement at all. Fact check, true.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.